Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm so happy now to welcome to the program Charlie O'Leary. He is Executive Director of the Santa Fe Conservation Trust, and I would like to introduce Jack Leffler. He is a writer, radio producer, oral historian, environmental activist, and he is being honored this year at the Santa Fe Conservation Trust Stuart Udall Legacy Dinner, which is this coming Sunday, September 18th. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Glad to be here.
So let's talk about the Santa Fe Conservation Trust for a moment, and then Stuart Udall. What's the Conservation Trust all about?
So the Santa Fe Conservation Trust is the local land trust here in Santa Fe. We've been around for 17 years. Stuart Udall was a founding member of the trust, and we work on protecting open space, wildlife habitat. We work in San Miguel, Santa Fe, Rio Arriba counties. And we work with private landowners who are interested in conserving their land, that want to see their land kept in its natural state and really leave a legacy to the community by conserving their property.
Now, do you do that through, you do it through buying property and through what's called conservation easements?
Right. We do it through conservation easements, which we also call voluntary landowner agreements. And landowners are able to essentially retire the development rights off of the property through this agreement. And then this agreement is on file with the county. It's a legal document. It's in perpetuity, on file, as I said, with the county. And it runs with the land so that as the land is transferred from one owner to another, this agreement stays in place. And our role at the trust is to work with whoever the landowner is to make sure that the terms of the easement are being met.
Let's talk now about Stuart Udall. Stuart Udall, father of our Senator Tom Udall, was one of the great leaders of his time in land conservation. And Jack, you interviewed him many times.
Yes, actually, Stuart was an old and very, very, very dear friend of mine. I've known him since he was still Secretary of the Interior. I actually met him one day when he was trying to repair a kitchen cabinet in their home in McLean, Virginia, and I thought he was the handyman, but it turned out it was Stuart Udall himself. At any rate, seeing Stuart's evolution through the years after he was Secretary of the Interior with regard to his thinking was an amazing thing to behold. And one of the things I should mention is that Stuart and Lee, his wife, were like family to me in many respects. Got to know them both extremely well, very, very well, among the five dearest friends in this lifetime, really. And watching Stuart's mind work, even up to the very end, I was with him 3 days before he passed away. He grinned at me, said adios y buena suerte, goodbye and good luck. We shook hands in the old revolutionary handshake, and away we both went. He went to wherever he wanted to go at that moment in time. But Stuart had an enormous impact. In my humble opinion, Stuart was our best Secretary of the Interior. At one point, I asked him about another great secretary, Harold Ickes, and he pointed out that Harold Ickes was the only Secretary of the Interior that would have ever served for 13 years by virtue of having worked with Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But basically, back in the early 1960s, Stuart authored an enormously influential book, The Quiet Crisis, which really affected a huge perspective, or created a huge perspective that a lot of the modern environmental movement actually related to. And one of the things I'd like to mention is the two people who helped Stuart with that book, which is little known, were Wallace Stegner and historian Alvin Josephi. And I remember having met the Stegners just before Wallace died here in Santa Fe. They were staying with the Udalls. And Alvin became one of my dearest friends and a great mentor, along with Stuart, in the world of history. And so seeing how Stuart factored history and the evolution of history into his own thinking. He could actually, he was very prescient in many ways and could almost forecast future ways, especially environmentally, that we would be flowing culturally.
What was this book about?
Well, it talked about the big crisis that we're currently in the middle of, which basically reflects the fact of overpopulation on a planet of limited resources, and how do we contend with this? It's one of the most important books. He did a subsequent book called Quiet Crisis Revisited or something like that. I have both of the books at home, but nonetheless, that's Stewart and his prescience. I will say this, there were several books that came out in the early 1960s, another one being Paul Ehrlich's The Population Bomb, and one that Stewart really, gee whiz, if I can remember the book, it was, The Silent Spring by Rachel Carson had an enormous impact on Stewart's thinking, and subsequently he alluded to her in just about every conversation over a period of over 40 years that we ever had.
It is really amazing to think about the accomplishments of Stuart Udall during the 8 years as Secretary of Interior. And I just jotted down a couple of things. I want to read this list. During his 8 years, he was responsible in part, but his leadership really helped pass 4 national parks, 6 national monuments, 17 assorted seashores, lakes, and recreation areas, 20 historic sites, and 56 wildlife refuges. So he was a busy man in those 8 years, and you know, this is really just one component of the work that he was involved in.
One of the things that really, I got to listen in September of 1964 when the Wilderness Act was signed into law by the Congress of the United States. And I'd like to mention that for many years in their living room, the Udalls had a coffee table, glass-covered coffee table. Beneath the glass, you could see the pens of all of the people who signed the bill and the pen of Lyndon B. Johnson, who ultimately signed the bill.
Is that right?
The Wilderness Bill of 1964 was huge, an enormous accomplishment.
One of the things that's so striking to me is how much our society has changed just in my lifetime. So the Wilderness Bill of 1964 was signed, and the country was in a completely different mentality than it is now. Nothing like that could ever be signed now. Heck, Medicare couldn't be signed now. What has changed?
Well, the human population of the planet has certainly changed. In 1964, it was somewhere in the vicinity of 3 billion people, 3 to 4 billion people, and now it is 7 billion people. In the subsequent decades since that period, our need for energy, or our perceived need for energy, has become enormous to the extent that any pocket of resources, common pool resources, this is an important factor, is now up for grabs for privatization in order to turn that habitat into money. And I think that that is one of the big motivating forces that exists now that did not exist, at least nearly to that extent, in 1964.
It's turning habitat into money. It's also, and that's a phrase of yours that I love, which is a very important way of thinking about land. It's also turning habitat into energy, turning habitat into computers, turning habitat into food and into all these other things that we need. And that makes it complicated because we like to eat and we like to have computers and we like to have energy.
Absolutely. And this is probably a cycle. You know, it's a dilemma of such enormous proportions that there are no easy answers to this. However, one of the answers that we could factor into this tapestry is if we use a little bit more discretion on an individual basis and then subsequently on a collective basis, and if we finally get it to the corporate basis. In other words, if we can re-educate people in the corporate milieu as well as the people in the grassroots, we stand a chance of turning it around. However, we have to really look very carefully at the fact that the resources have diminished in direct proportion to population growth and perceived need. And so we are looking at the potential for a complete disaster if we're not really careful and get into it right now. We cannot afford to ever lay back for another second in this lifetime to try to turn it around.
the problem that never really gets talked about in public, although it gets talked about over the dinner table all the time, is the problem not only of population growth, but of the perceived necessity of economic growth as the only way to have an economy. And economic growth was possible as long as there was a frontier, as long as there were new territories to open, as long as there were huge new markets and huge new swaths of resources. But when you use your resources, and Africa is now the place that is being exploited, but when you use these resources up, you can't have a growth model anymore. Or when you use resources to the point where life becomes unsustainable, you can't have a growth model.
One of the things that I'd like to mention is Edward Abbey's great apothegm, growth for the sake of growth is the ideology of the cancer cell. And I think that this is a hugely important thing to recognize, that we have become, well, actually in Ed's own words, Ed was also a very dear friend. Matter of fact, I had the great honor of introducing Stuart and Ed to each other at one point in my living room in Santa Fe. But Ed pointed out that indeed our culture could be perceived by some objective being far out in space as a metastasis on this planet. Now, that's not a good thought. However, in many respects, it's certainly metaphorically right on the button. And so how do we demetastasize on a planet of finite resources that is already overburdened and falling into, there are so many systems of factors now that overlap that any two factors within any of these systems could bring us down, mm-hmm. like total economic collapse in conjunction with pandemic or something like that.
Well, and I like to think of, not growth for the sake of growth, but what about development? How can we as a community and a society move forward and develop and not just grow in size? And what does that mean in terms of our resource use and being smarter about how we come together and interact and use our resources? And actually, I like to think about the work that we do at the Trust as a way in terms of working with landowners as a placeholder or a bookmark for property and saying, okay, let's just put this land aside. I mean, there's a lot of the land is still being used, but essentially, let's not just assume it needs to be developed. What are some other options for the land, and how do we participate as a community member in the overall health of the planet and the cities and the communities? And so we do try and not just promote this growth, but how do we, it's a good question. How do we do that when so much is based on, so much of our economy is based on growth? I also like to think about the speed of which things are happening these days. And I think, everybody's very busy. And how do we slow down a little bit and think about what we're doing and be in the present a bit more? And again, coming back to the land and trying to rebuild the land ethic and look around and, ask ourselves why do we enjoy living in Santa Fe? What is it about this environment and this natural world that really holds people to this this part of the state?
I'd like to bring up something right here that's apropos, I do believe. One of the thoughts that I've been really pushing of late has to do with restoration ecology in conjunction with cultural restoration. And what has brought that hugely to mind just in the last few weeks is the enormous fire, New Mexico's biggest fire of all time, which took place on the eastern aspect of the Jemez Mountain, which took out Santa Clara Canyon, a canyon that is absolutely sacred to the Santa Clara Pueblo. And it could have brought ruination to that whole culture. And one of the things that I've hoped to lobby in behalf of and have with Congressman Ben Ray Lujan is thinking in terms of congressional financing of restoration of that habitat. Now, that restoration could not achieve the former Santa Clara Canyon for a century because the fire was so incredibly deep. But what I was thinking was if indeed something like congressional funding to allow the Santa Clara people to restore that ecosystem starting now and seeing how it would take generations for it to achieve total restoration, if it can, how that could also help them re-achieve some sense of cultural restoration within their own milieu. Now, one of the things that I've felt forever, and this has been one of the things I've worked on, is that Native American cultures, everywhere I've been, and as an oral historian, I've been an awful lot of places with my microphones recording these people, I've yet to meet a traditional Native American person who does not hold the land as sacred. Now, we in our culture have had an enormous proclivity for secularizing habitat. And I think in terms of our own restoration ecology for areas that we have just raised after in our eternal quest for natural resources, if we could consciously restore those ecosystems in a way that could involve our own cultural restoration in a way of understanding that this planet is a living organism. I mean, you just really have to see it that way. And as such, it is not a secular place. It is a very sacred place. And this is something that the Native American people really understand. This is something that Stuart understood.
The question of how to institutionalize that and how to make that a part of your daily life is also kind of challenging. I think we are trained to think first about ourselves and our families, bringing home a paycheck, having your finances in order, and things like that. And sometimes, depending on who you're working for and what that company is doing, that, which is a perfectly normal thing and necessary thing, is completely antithetical to thinking about the greater whole. So you're working for a company and you are bringing home a paycheck, and that company is destroying, for example, well, let's hope this doesn't happen, but Otero Mesa. That is a place that we've talked about, a beautiful and very important place ecologically in the state of New Mexico that has just so many different species, grasslands, mammals, fresh drinking water underneath it, and all of these things. And a mining company wants to do mountaintop mining, and that would virtually destroy Otero Mesa. Okay, you're working for the company that does that, and you're keeping your family fed. How do you think about all those things together?
You know, I think it's very challenging, and I think a lot of it has to do with the shift of how we look at time and how we look at planning for the future and talking about the future in terms of seven generations forward. You know, what is important to us in terms of the amount of resources that we have today and how we use those wisely so that we do have them available for future generations. And again, I think this also gets back to sort of the speed of our lifestyles today. I don't think it needs to be a luxury to think about how one's work fits into the larger scheme of humans and our interaction with the planet. I mean, I definitely don't want to belittle your question. I think it's very important and very challenging for folks who are in certain positions as you bring a paycheck home for your family. But I think it's this shift that we talked about in terms of how society starts to put long-term goals ahead of sort of short-term economic gain.
That's a huge question that I've struggled with for over 40 years at this point. And I'll give the example of the Black Mesa debacle that occurs in northern Arizona. April of 1970, I spoke before a group of traditional Hopi people about the imminent strip mining of Black Mesa for coal in order to fire a power plant that would provide electricity for the Central Arizona Project, which to me remains the most amazing example of what not to do in the American West. But because not only did it destroy a huge amount of habitat and destroy a large segment of the aquifer, it also really brought two traditional cultures, Hopi and Navajo, to their knees. It created what my wife refers to as the March of the Electric Kachinas, with the power lines going from the banks of Lake Powell, where the power plant was, all the way down to the Central Valleys, well, to the Lake of Havasu, in order to pump water into the Central Valleys of Arizona, and thus water a very fragile desert, the Sonoran Desert, and cause development. So that is a whole map of what not to do. We vigorously fought that with lawsuits, got as far as the Supreme Court. But what we learned was the extent to which the Peabody Coal Company and other corporations had their fingers in our body politic. And so one thing that we have to do is make sure that we elect officials who are on the side of habitat rather than on the side of turning habitat into money. And that is a big, big issue right there.
It's a big problem because their campaigns are paid for by the very people that you want them to oppose.
And so one of the biggest campaigns that we have to force right now is making illegal that kind of contribution to put somebody's parrot or puppet into Congress.
We're talking to Jack Leffler, oral historian and writer and environmental activist, and Charlie O'Leary, executive director of the Santa Fe Conservation Trust. I thought we could listen to a track from a disc that you have called Stuart Udall, The Early Years. Now, this is an interview between Jack Leffler and Stuart Udall that was recorded 4 years ago. It was recorded in, no, 5 years ago, in 2006, 4 years before Stuart Udall's death. And this is about the New Deal legacy and thrift and credit card culture and all of that.
One of the things that I was really interested in listening back to this interview after I'd done it, actually, I've spent a lot of time talking to Stuart and some of that time recording him. And it seems to me that the New Deal that occurred back in the 1930s under the auspices of Franklin Delano Roosevelt when he became president to try to pull America out of a Great Depression, even though we hadn't gone into our current recession in 2006 when Laura Udall, Stuart's younger daughter, and I were there with him, it seemed terribly appropriate to look at the two times in juxtaposition. So if we are listening to this track of Stuart talking about the New Deal of the 1930s, and imagine how a really, I won't say forceful, but an energetic and vital president could revitalize America, not just the economy, but bring people together. The New Deal resulted in things like the CCC camps, for example, which had a lot to do.
Conservation Corps.
Yeah, a Civilian Conservation Corps, trained, ironically, by the Army. And subsequently, a lot of those people ended up in the Army to fight in World War II. But in other words, to juxtapose those times when the population was about 2 billion people on the planet and we had just gone through the collapse of 1929 of Wall Street and people were really scuffling, and I remember it well. I remember watching people fishing for catfish in the Ohio River. And if they didn't catch a fish, they didn't eat that night. To the way it is right now, when we live in a world of applied techno-fantasy and think we have problems, you know, relative to those people, well, we do have problems. And I think that what Stuart has to say about economics and thrift and the spirit of our country as appropriate for that time should really be listened to for this time.
Well, let's take a listen. This is an interview between Jack Leffler and Stuart Udall, former Secretary of the Interior.
Not a whole bunch of people now really realize that there are still some programs that evolved during the New Deal that are still with us, like Social Security and the FDIC and stuff like that. And those are the enduring things. One of the things I've been recently reading is that the definitions between liberal and conservative got redefined during the New Deal time. And basically, the term liberal, which had meant something to do with a social liberalism prior to the Great Depression, during the time of the Great Depression, somebody who was regarded as a liberal was somebody who was pro-New Deal, and somebody who was regarded as conservative was against the New Deal. And yet, some of the greatest things that have ever occurred in this country with regard to the preservation of all of us, really, things like Social Security and the FDIC, which helped ensure that the banks would remain solvent. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Jack, there was no And this was the idea of the dominance of business and so on. There was no safety net. Social Security came along, but it took a few years for that to take effect and so on. Or health care was concerned. It was the business of the family. Families take care of people who got cancer. You didn't have hospitals. You took care of them in your home. And that was the business of people. And all these programs that we take for granted now as part of our birthright, you know, health care, Social Security, taking care of older people, this all grew out of the Depression. But the Depression kids, and those of us that grew up in the Depression and then fought the war, we were nurtured on this tradition of learning how to subsist, of people helping other people in the family, of this tradition of taking care of your own people. That was very different. And I believe that tradition continued on, you know. The idea that is now so an integral part of our culture of credit cards and credit. I remember Lee's mother, who had six children. Her husband died just before the Depression. She reared six children on $150 a month from workman's compensation. And $150 a month was cash, was important money. When I was went into Kennedy's cabinet, my mother came and Lee's mother came, and my wife took her mother to Lord and Taylor, some big store in Washington, D.C. This is 1960, but it shows the culture produced by the Depression. And she was buying a dress. She was a seamstress, actually, but she was one of the first times she bought a dress to wear at the Kennedy inaugural and so on. And the woman said, "Charge it?" He said, "I wouldn't buy it if I couldn't pay for it." that's the Depression attitude of people. Debt, we abhor debt. Parties argued a little bit from time to time, you know, but a balanced budget of a family or the government was very, very important. And that continued after the war. And we essentially, all of us, by determination, there was going to be no war profiteering like there was in World War I. And so workers were paid very modest salaries. 30% of the workforce in the factories during World War II, after we got started, were women. The famous Rosie the Riveter. I mean, they had to develop skills and did things, but a private was paid $29 a month, and I don't think that changed during the war. You if you were in the Army or the Navy, you were in the service, and so on, you didn't need any money anyway, except if you're going to go out on a weekend spree. And so you sent your paychecks home. You could sign a piece of paper, and your paycheck went home, and your family bought war bonds. I had, I think, $1,700 at the end of the war that my parents had in war bonds. I bought my first car in 1947 when I cashed in some of my war bonds. It was a little Ford, and I think it cost $1,200, and that was my first big expenditure. I had to buy a car so my wife and I could go on our honeymoon. and so the effects of the Depression, the way it developed personal values, the way it influenced your attitude towards money and how important it was to save was built into the system. We're now in 2006. I saw a few months ago that the savings rate, people in this country don't save anymore. They charge. They run their credit cards. That the savings rate last year, I guess in 2005, dropped so low that you had to look at the 1934, 1935, the depths of the Depression, for a savings rate that was comparable. And, of course, there wasn't much to save then. That shows how thrifty we had to be. Thrift was sort of built into the system. You didn't buy anything you couldn't afford.
And that was Stuart Udall in an interview with Jack Loeffler, which was recorded on May 29th, 2006. And one of the things that brings up for me, this clip, is that a depression, horrible as it is, and all the losses of life and livelihood that occurred, isn't all bad, because people's values that were formed during the Depression have a tremendous amount of strength, the values of helping one another and the values of thrift.
One of the things that Stuart brought out, perhaps either earlier or later in the interview, was that what really got us out of the Depression was the spirit that maintained America during the Second World War. Now, fiscally, we restored ourselves in large measure by the industry that occurred during the Second World War, considering the fact that Japan Air Force took out much of our Navy at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. The entire American culture went to work in behalf of staving off the Axis, as both Germany, Italy, and Japan were then known. Now, trying to imagine that particular context within today's world is very difficult, because we live in a totally different world, and since the Second World War, our whole sense of economy has shifted once again to overexpenditure, which is precisely where it was at in 1928, just before we went into the Great Depression. Well, we're in just as significant a depression in many ways, but it's not quite as available to many of us as it was to all of those people back then. People back then, Stuart talked a lot about growing up in a rural environment of southern Arizona in St. John's, basically. He lived on a farm. His dad was both a judge and a farmer. And Stuart would get up in the middle of the night to go out and check the acequia to make sure that the gate would open into the fields. Well, we still have remnants of that culture right here in northern New Mexico with the Hispano acequia point of view, which is very important, and their whole system of thought with regard to water law differs greatly than our own. They don't imagine privatization of water as something that could be even thought of. But getting back to the issue at hand, one of the things that gives me great concern, worries me enormously, is the extent to which we as a culture over the last 20 years have had this incredible proclivity for virtualizing everything by virtue of the internet, by virtue of the computer, and all of that stuff. And we need to get out in the real McCoy. One of the things I've been working on forever, really, since 1964, when I realized up at Navajo Mountain, Utah, where I was living in a hogan for 7 months, was the degree to which a culture is shaped by the habitat that it, in other words, there was a time when environmental determinism was bandied about as a lousy thing to say, but that's not true. Environment in great measure determines the way any culture, whether it be red ants in an anthill or whether it's people living in that culture, it helps shape the perspective to the extent that, as you mentioned earlier in a private conversation, that we, as the keystone species, we actually reflect the habitat that we are, where we have our cadencia, where we have our major tie to homeland. This is something that modern culture has lost a lot since the 1930s, is that tie to homeland modern culture has, because we've become so mobile.
Yeah, and I mean, I marvel sometimes. I haven't been there for a long time, but I like to visit New York City, and I find it really exciting, and I just love that city. But I mean, I remember walking down the street and seeing fruit and flowers and meat and cheese, none of which comes from New York City. It all comes from elsewhere, and the incredible infrastructure that is necessary to bring in food from elsewhere. I mean, it works until it stops working, but that is not a land-based culture. Around here, we could be a little bit closer, and once were.
I want to mention something. In 1974, I think it was, Art Trujillo, who was then the chairman of our county commission, asked me, basically, to get the first neighborhood association going up in Santa Fe Canyon. And the first person I called was Stuart. Stuart already owned land up in the house where he passed away, up behind St. John's College. And Stuart's great thought at that moment in time, and this is a long time ago, 1974, is that, or five at the latest, that Santa Fe have a green belt all the way around it, wherein we could become autonomous agriculturally, which
very
is a
interesting,
very big thought. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I'd like to mention, I have a cousin who works with the EPA, and he's brought up the fact that Detroit, which has been a greatly depressed region as the result of automobile industry shutting down,
right,
they now have developed a whole infrastructure based on big community gardens.
Right, exactly.
And I think that that's really far out.
We're talking to Charlie O'Leary, Executive Director of the Santa Fe Conservation Trust, and Jack Leffler, writer, environmental activist, oral historian, on the occasion of the Stuart Udall Legacy Dinner, which is happening this Sunday, September 18th. One of the things that you said a moment ago, Jack, made me think about you were talking about we have virtualized reality, and instead of getting out there and digging in the dirt and walking around, we're kind of doing it virtually through the internet. But I'll tell you something. I mean, if I want to know how to grow lettuce, I go on the internet and figure out how to grow lettuce. And there are so many things that relate to making a more ecological life for yourself that you can actually find a lot of tips about and find them instantly and save a ton of time by going on the internet.
I would like to address this. I thought about this a lot from my vantage point on Muley Point this last weekend. My daughter and I went camping up there, which is an amazing place in southern Utah from where you can see about a third of the Colorado Plateau. And I sat up there without my computer, and she sat up there without her computer. And what happened to me over a very brief period of time was that my mind suddenly stopped being in the intellectual turmoil in which I find myself so much of the time as I'm engaged with the computer as a writer and as a radio producer. And suddenly my intuitions began to click back into place. And I realized that we have a tendency in this culture where we have vast application and misapplication of science and technology, that we have had a real occasion to allow a lot of those intuitive processes where we understand our kindred relationship with the flow of nature to atrophy if we're not very, very careful.
Well, there's a balance, isn't there? Because, I mean, my intuition, if I sit there and meditate on a mountaintop, I still won't know how to grow lettuce.
No, but if you sit there and think about it long enough, you could. I'm not saying that I use the Google every single day. As a matter of fact, I still have my Encyclopedia Britannica sitting right beside me, and I realized that it's been over a year since I blew the dust off the top of that encyclopedia. But I use the Google all the time, but I always go outside for hours every day, and if I don't, I'm incomplete.
You know, and I think this brings back the point of balance, and how do we use technology appropriately and still nurture and respect our intuition. And we were talking earlier again about getting out in nature, and one of the things that the Trust has done is has promoted local trails, and we were part of putting the Dale Ball Trail system together and the rail trail out to Lamy. And while it's wonderful to be in your yard, it's also great to get out, walk around, walk on some of these trails, do some exploring, and spend enough time so that your intuition starts to come back, so that you spend enough time and you start thinking about what's happening to the trail, what's happening to the trees around you, how's the water flowing off the trail. There's been a lot of action lately from these storms and how they're impacting the trail and how we use water. And I think that's where, you know, those conversations with ourselves are not happening nearly as much as we had in the past.
Apropos of that rail trail, I remember Stuart Udall talking so much about working on that trail back in, gee whiz, a long time ago. And that trail goes right by my house. And so every morning I hobble out to that trail.
Oh, that's great to know.
Hobble down the trail. Mary Charlotte has been to my house, and it's just west of the house out there.
So walking out on the rail trail, walking in the landscape, and it's something that we in New Mexico have kind of the, shouldn't be a privilege, but privilege to do is be in the city and then be outdoors simultaneously or within a few minutes of each other. But it's also important to understand, as you're doing that, I mean, not just the beauty of the individual plants and mountain ranges and land, which are indeed beautiful, and the smells and the changes from season to season, but also the big picture, like what is a watershed and how do these places function as ecosystems and as providers of things like clean water and oxygen and so on.
Absolutely, and the rail trail connects Santa Fe to Lamy and part of what we call the Galisteo Basin and the Galisteo Basin watershed. And this is an area that drains it when it rains the whole Galisteo Basin into the Galisteo Creek and into the Rio Grande. And we at the Trust are starting to look at larger landscapes in our planning efforts and identifying these types of action as you were just describing. How does the landscape cycle water and provide clean water? How does it contribute to clean air and these things that we take for granted? And what it requires is to go beyond just the beauty of these areas and the wonder of them and start to look at how they're really systems and living systems and important to our communities and critical to supporting our lives.
And what I find fascinating is that your work, Jack Leffler, all these interviews you've done with Native people over the years show that understanding is not some new scientific thing that we've just come across in the last 100 years.
Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, I just finished a radio series that's now going around public radio stations throughout the country called Watersheds as Commons, which is a concept that's intuitively understood by Native American cultures everywhere. In other words, it's a common pool resource in the jargon of today's economists like Eleanor Ostrom and even Garrett Hardin, who's no longer with us. But what is really important is to try to understand that Native American perspective as to how they see themselves as kindred with the watershed itself, that the whole thing really is indeed a system, just as Charlie was saying, when one of the components goes missing, the system has to go through an incredible rearrangement of itself in order to continue to function, if indeed it can. And I would also like to mention that UNM Press is now about to publish a book that my daughter and I put together. It's an anthology of essays and interviews with a lot of Native American people and Hispanos, ranchers, and others. And it's called Thinking Like a Watershed, which is metaphoric. It's also a great ripoff of Aldo Leopold's notion of thinking like a mountain.
Right.
But it seems to me the thinking like a watershed has a lot more motion to it than thinking like a mountain.
Indeed, a lot more motion. Mountains do tend to be kind of static, whereas water is the life, literally the lifeblood of the planet.
Does a mountain have its own thoughts? That was one of Ed Abbey's questions.
That's good.
Question that cannot be answered right at this moment on this radio show.
Well, and what it brings up for us as well at the Trust is being able to look at these areas of the land and not necessarily just look at political boundaries. I mean, that's been a sort of a simplified way that we've looked at our land for a long time in terms of county boundaries or state or national boundaries. And the natural environment just doesn't abide by those. And to fully understand how these areas work and how we interact with them, we need to take a larger look at the full picture.
And one of the things that I think reflects that really beautifully is a map rendered by John Wesley Powell back in 1889.
I love that map. Tell
Isn't
us about that map.
I love that map, too. And one day, Bill DeBuis, a dear friend, came by with a book that he was putting together about John Wesley Powell years ago. And he showed me the picture of this, and I got so stoked by it that I've spent the last several years working because of that picture. But in the 1889-90 USGS, it's the 11th annual report to the USGS put together.
The USGS is the U.S. Geological Survey.
Right. At which point John Wesley Powell himself was the director. He created a map that shows the watersheds of the American West, basically west of the 100th meridian, which separates the verdant east from the arid west. And you can see in different big colors and subtly differing hues, different watersheds, about 150 of them. And he contended vigorously before the Congress of the United States that we should organize ourselves politically by watersheds, because it was the only sane way to go and to really forestall any idea of interbasin transfers of water, which we have failed to do miserably.
And so that basically state and county boundaries should be based on watersheds instead of straight grid lines that we have here in the West.
Yeah, the geopolitical boundaries that we have reflect a hodgepodge of lack of real insight as to the way we really have to comport ourselves. Had we adopted Powell's system, we would be conscious of our habitat to an infinitely greater degree than we are today.
And it's so interesting because that basically drawing boundaries that way changes culture, and not drawing them that way changes culture.
It certainly does. And he was basically shot down by land developers who really wanted to get in here and make money out of raising the West. It was just another continuation of one of the big things that's happened in American culture, which is called manifest destiny. And that has been one of the great tragedies of the last 200 years.
Jack Loeffler is a writer, radio producer, environmental activist, and oral historian. Charlie O'Leary is executive director of the Santa Fe Conservation Trust. And once again, this Sunday, the 18th of September, is the Stuart Udall Legacy Dinner, sponsored by the Santa Fe Conservation Trust, and honoring Jack Loeffler. A wonderful event, and if people want to, are there any tickets left for that?
There are. We still have tickets available, and you can call the Santa Fe Conservation Trust at 989-7019 to purchase tickets. It is our annual fundraiser, and we will be honoring Jack Loeffler. We're very excited about it, and yes, we do still have tickets available. The website is also an area where you can purchase tickets. It's www.sfct.org, Santa Fe Conservation Trust.
Charlie O'Leary and Jack Loeffler, thanks so much for being with us, and hope to see you on the show again soon.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.